So thank you for all coming out to listen to my talk. I'm going to apologize. I'm going to be a little bit more toned down than normal because I've been under the weather the past couple of days, but hopefully you all enjoy the talk. So administration is prone to faults because the systems we use and administer are very complicated, and this makes a lot of the tasks we have to do complicated as well. Faults that can occur into two categories. They're accidental faults and malicious faults. Accidental faults are a lot of times configuration errors that we make to the machines. These can that we install something new that really doesn't play well with what's already there. We change a configuration of a system that was working and in a way that doesn't play nice with it either. And these can affect stability, that a system that ran perfectly fine before now has processes that are crashing, can't handle the load, or it can even affect security, that we open up security holes that should not exist on the system because we installed something bad or configured something wrong. The other type of fault is sort of a malicious fault, that administrators are basically God to the system and they have full rights to the system and can do whatever they want. There are many examples of administrators who are leaving an organization who have installed back doors because of a malicious need to have access to the system even after they're gone. And also because they're God to the system, because they can, even if you have systems in place to check their actions, they can actually disable them. So these systems are not really effective against the administrator. A relatively well-known example in the government community was Robert Hansen, the FBI. I guess he worked in the counterintelligence group, and he was actually a double agent for the Soviets, and he was able to get away with his actions for so long because he was one of the system administrators for one of the systems that the counterintelligence unit used, and he was able to see whenever they were doing anything that could reveal his actions and was able to tone down what he was doing. So how do we deal with this today? Well, one way, example in compartmentalized workstations or going all the way back to Multics, is that you can divide up the role of a system administrator, and that you don't have a single all-powerful person, you have multiple people that have to be involved in doing some administration action. But this really only helps you for malicious faults, in that one person might not be able to do the malicious action himself. It's still very possible that an accidental fault can creep into the system. You have other things like sudo sh, which record what a user, what the administrator is doing, and can replay those keystrokes. But the problem with this system is that you're not really guaranteed that just because the same steps are done that the same action will happen. A simple example is that if I really want to be malicious, I can create my own package that looks like a regular package that should be installed into the machine, put it on a place where I have write access, download it, so it's recorded that I downloaded it, install it, it looks like I installed the normal package, and then remove it or replace it with the normal package that doesn't have the backdoor in it. Just replaying the keystrokes won't really tell you that anything bad happened. And finally, a common way that faults in general systems are prevented is through what we call two-person control. That you need basically two people for every action. A common example of this is with nukes, that we need two people to turn the key to launch a nuke. Or if you run a business, a lot of times, bank the checks that you write, you'll need two people to sign the check. In planes, we're supposed to have two pilots so that just because there's a check, if one of the pilots does something wrong. Though as we saw, I guess, recently, it doesn't always work because sometimes they'll overshoot their target by an hour and a half because they're in the middle of a deep conversation. So we want to take this two-person control mechanism, this model, and apply it to general computing and system administration in particular. We call it ICE-T for I see everything twice. So it's a general mechanism that enables us to do three things. We can take an existing environment and clone it to make multiple environments from that previously existing environment. We can now independently execute within these clones and compare the results of these independent executions to see how they differ, how they're the same. We apply this model to system administration by taking a machine that has to be administered, and create two clones of it. Then we can give each clone to separate system administrators to do the administration that has to be done in it independently. We can then compare the results of the administration for equivalence to see, did they do the same thing? How do they differ? And show each of them how they differ if they're not the same. This can help prevent the sort of accidental and malicious faults that I discussed earlier. Number one, if we have two administrators performing tasks independently, it's very unlikely that they'll both perform the same accidental mistake. They might both make accidental mistakes themselves, but it's unlikely they'll make the same one, and so the system will catch that. Similarly, for malicious fault, the problem with this is that this type of model of administration is very expensive. If we have to have two administrators to do everything, you can imagine it being used in a military context or maybe in a banking context. But it's not necessarily as applicable to sort of general concepts. But we believe that this model, at least the architecture, can be used with limited increased expense in other environments. For instance, it can be used to train junior system administrators, it can be used to provide an audit trail, and it can also be combined with configuration management in a way that doesn't increase the total cost of the system tremendously. So how can it be used with training junior system administrators? Just like we can clone the system to capture changes for multiple administrators, we can clone it for just a single administrator. And we give that clone to the junior SA to administrate, and the system will capture all the changes, what he did to the system, what he changed. Instead of a senior administrator having to examine a live system to decide if anything has to be changed, he can simply look at the list of changes before they're committed to the underlying system and approve or disapprove of those changes based on his experience administering these systems. We can also use it to provide an audit trail. This is sort of what I would call a form of offline two-person control. What we do, similar to the junior system administrator case, we have a single system administrator perform his tasks within a clone, which captures all the changes that will be performed. But instead of having someone approve of it immediately, it gets committed to the underlying system immediately. But it also gets checked into a separate sort of audit control service that is also tagged with a task number from an issue tracker or a description of what the changes are supposed to be. In the future, an auditor can come around and check a random sampling of these administration states that have been checked into the server and see, do they correspond to the issue tracker numbers that they say they do? Are there things that belong or things that don't belong? And we know from experience in banking and in other services that a lot of times a good audit is a good method to prevent malicious faults from creeping into a system because a malicious user knows his actions will be detected. Finally, ICT can also be used with configuration management. In configuration management, the managed machines are not administered directly. Instead, we have a policy server which has a set of template configuration files and its own language on how to deploy those configuration files to the managed machines, as well as fill them in. With ICT, we apply ICT to this policy server. We don't have to manage the individual machines. We don't have to deal with a lot of the complicated tasks that occur because the configuration management system already handles this. So ICT will just be used to manage the configuration management system's files directly. And I'll talk about it a little bit more later. So what is ICT's architecture? There are basically three components to it. We have an isolation container for each administrator to operate in independently. We provide a special file system for branching and change isolation for each container so that each container will provide the view of the machine they're managing, but also isolate the changes. I'll talk about that. And we have a system service for provisioning these instances as well as comparing the changes that occur. So what are its isolation container? It's pretty simple. We use both OS containers. These are things like Solaris Zones, Linux vServer, or now in new kernels, the Linux container mechanism. On BSD, you can probably use something like FreeBSD jails, though I don't have significant experience in that. These are lightweight, very quick to instantiate, that there's no impact on sort of creating one, as they're basically instantaneous. But you can't do everything that you might want to when you're administering a system within them. For instance, if you want to test a kernel upgrade. With hardware virtualization, such as VMware, we can do that. We can test how new kernels will behave, reboot the system as needed. But they're more heavyweight. They take much longer to instantiate and can be more complicated for heavyweight, for quick tasks that have to be done. The second component is ICT's file system. And there are two main requirements that we need from the file system. We must be able to branch or clone itself very quickly. And there are lots of file systems that can do this. Last night at the BOFS, I heard a lot of things about ZFS. ZFS is very good at cloning itself. And there are other systems in Linux. We're going to have BTRFS. A lot of VM architectures have snapshotting and cloning of the VM so that you can branch a virtual disk very quickly. But the problem with these is that they're not able to satisfy the second requirement that ICT needs, and that we need to be able to easily isolate the changes that occur to these disks, to these file systems. The main way we would tell what changes is we'd have to iterate through the whole file system. If you have a big file system, this can take a lot of time, as well impact performance of the general system because you're going to be doing a lot of I/O. So our solution for this is to basically leverage unioning file systems. And as I'm not exactly sure everyone here knows about how unioning file systems work, I'm going to give a short discussion on them for those who don't know. And if you do know about them, please bear with me. So how does a unioning file system work? Basically, it lets us take multiple named file system namespaces that would generally be distinct and create a single namespace that is the union set of all of them. So in this example, I have three separate namespaces, one for OpenOffice, one for Firefox, one for GIMP. Each has a set of files. And in the union file namespace, we have all those files within a single namespace. We can also use this file system namespace in a manner where we can add and modify files in it. In that, even if we don't want to change the underlying namespace, we can create a read-only namespace, and this is what I call a read-only layer. And we can add a read-write layer on top of it. If we add a file, in this case, a test file in my home directory, it will be added to the read-write layer, and it will be visible in the union file system namespace like a normal file. Similarly, if we have a file that has to be modified, in this case, say I'm going to modify bin login, it will be copied up to the read-write layer before it's modified, and then the modifications can occur. And in the union file system namespace, we'll see the modified file. You can imagine that this is very good for intrusion detection, as I'll talk about a little bit later, because whatever modifications occur to underlying files will have to be stored in the read-write layer. And we can also delete files by storing a whiteout file within the read-write layer and this will hide whatever file was in existence in the union namespace. So using this, we can use this file system to create the branchable file system that ICT needs in order to do its enable the two-person control model for system administration. That if we give each clone that we create for each administrator a two-layer union. The bottom layer is the file system of the underlying machine that's being managed. And the union has only access to it in a read-only manner. We also give it a top layer, which is initially empty. But this layer will store whatever changes, be they files that are added, files that are modified, files that are deleted, that this system administrator performs to the system. We can all to then compare the systems. All we have to do is compare the contents of the two top layers from both of the system, from the top layers from both of the systems. So then the question is, how do we determine equivalence? How do we compare them? Do we just compare, do they have the exact same binary data? What about if there's a script that has different sets of white space? In some scripting language, white space doesn't matter, say in Perl. In other cases, it does matter, like in Python. So how do we need to write a parser for each language? This can be difficult. What about files that might not affect usage in practice? Say, files that end up in my slash root directory because of the editor I was using. One administrator used Emacs, the other one used VI, and they created different sorts of backup files. They created different, configuration files for themselves in the slash root directory. So our prototype, which we created to test the feasibility, took an easy approach in this. Number one, we figured out which files we can prune. For instance, we would prune all backup files because we don't need to commit those to the underlying system. It doesn't mean they're thrown away. It just means like each of the clones gets archived. It just means that we don't have to commit those to the underlying system to have it work. And we also then, based on the rest of the files, we do a set of rules to determine if these files are equivalent. Number one, does the file exist in both environments? If one person deleted a file and the other person didn't, or one person created a file and the other person didn't, or one person modified a file and the other person didn't, we know that they're not equivalent. We also then want to see if they have the same set of files, do they have the same set of permissions? Do they have the same UID? Do they have the same GID? We don't really care about date. It could matter, but for our purposes, our experience, it didn't matter so much. And finally, once we pass this test, are every directory entry are the same? Are they the same type? Is a device node the same type of node? Do symbolic links point to the same file? Do regular files have the same data? But the problem with this approach is that sometimes files can be semantically the same, as I discussed, but aren't exactly the same. And the other problem is that some files are dynamically created, such as encryption keys. I install SSH, other person installs SSH. We're going to end up with different keys into the system. So configuration management can help with the system in that we could teach ICT only one configuration language. As the templates that are part of this configuration management system will be fairly static. And the configuration management system already has experience in dealing with dynamic files. For instance, running scripts on each individual machine. It's not perfect as sort of if you want to create a database, we can't always deal with these things so well, but this is sort of future work. And we did a usage study to test the feasibility of the system. What we did was we gave a VMware VM to 10 experienced users and asked them to perform a set of administration tasks independently within our ICT environment, and we were able to capture the changes they made to the system performing those tasks, and then we're able to test all 10 sets of changes for each task against each other. The notable results of this are sort of as expected. When they were using package management systems to upgrade a machine, it was always equivalent. A more notable result was that when they built software from scratch, it was also equivalent. I was worried that perhaps if you built software from scratch, you'd have a problem in that the compiler would play games. In truth, unless the source code itself modifies itself for each build, sort of putting in a build date, it will be equivalent each time. As expected, SSH installation wasn't equivalent as each package generated its own key. And finally, when we asked them to create a backdoor, we were able to easily tell it because none of them created the same type of backdoor. They each did it a little bit differently. So the conclusions I want you to get from this are that this two-person control mechanism model can be applied to system administration and can provide great assurance of to prevent faults from entering a system. It's able to create these environments very quickly and record and isolate the changes that occur in a very efficient manner. And finally, for our experiment show, and you can see more in the paper, that it's effective in real-life administration tasks. And a lot of these are easy to compare for equivalence. And if there are any questions, I can take them now.
So in fairly typical large environments, usually having some sort of a configuration management system is par for the course. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on how a two-person method like you're describing here might work with what we usually do, which is using a version control system, CVS or SVN or something, where you can effectively implement some sort of a peer review system to the source files that go into the configuration management system.
So peer review could be considered like the junior SA, senior SA model I spoke about earlier, where you sort of isolate changes. The problem would be is that it's like in a version control system, I guess, unless you have a system where it's sort of first checked into the version control system and then sort of the policy server, so to speak, checks it out of there, it would be very easy for a malicious like SA to use the configuration management server that's in existence to deploy malicious changes just without checking them into the server. Like, you can sort of, I guess, use it, you can use an auditable model. You can change the model that, like, you talk to make it more auditable, but you don't have sort of the break that if someone wants to do something malicious, like, what's to prevent them from that from occurring, if I understand correctly.
Thanks.
At the front here.
Okay. Hi, Tom Limoncelli from Google. So I love this paper. I think it's really out there and great and crazy because Lisa needs more crazy papers. I want to say that first of all. I'm not sure if you recognize how crazy it is.
No. I recognize how crazy it is.
So I have a suggestion and a question. The suggestion is, have you considered, rather than requiring two people to do the same amount of work, one person does the work and the other person is shown the delta. You have the possibility of grading a
yeah, that, that's the sort of, I spoke about two cases that there was a sort of a junior-senior essay, like where you have a junior essay who the changes are captured, as well as
sorry,
auditable model.
I apologize. Okay. My other question is, have you, and this is really the more important question, it's about usability. Have you run a live service? And more importantly, would you be willing to run a web server for the next 6 months using this technique?
It depends on the type of web server I was running. If I was running like my personal machine, no, I don't need the assurances that this provides. If I was a bank, they might have systems in place that try to do this but aren't as formalized as this. And if I was running a bank, I'd probably be very interested in something like this to prevent faults from entering the system.
I agree. I'm wondering if you've tried just experiment
no.
to do it. Okay. What's the longest you've run a service on with this system?
So as I said, the experiments that we ran were feasibility.
Right.
Like it wasn't a sort of deployed thing. It was sort of can users administer a system? Individuals, like we had 10 users, we weren't doing it in pairs. We were just trying to see like where things would break down, where things compared very easily.
Okay.
It was
Thank
a feasibility you. Type test.
Thank you.
Jay Faulkner with Rackspace Email and Apps. I'm kind of actually going the same direction as Tom was of, this is awesome and crazy kind of all together. I was wondering if you thought about doing something like this on a slightly higher level, kind of like functional test for systems, as opposed to necessarily on the individual level, if you had investigated that at all.
I'm not, what do you mean functional?
For instance, if you know you're supposed to make a change to a server to make, you know, its hello name on the SMTP change, was there a thought to approaching this as, you know, two people do something in parallel and then see how the server acts at the end, as opposed to comparing the actual files they changed?
Actually, in the sort of proposal for like the general mechanism that I spoke about earlier, that's part of that whole vision, like sort of applying changes and sort of seeing if they actually work, because you know you have your sort, you have to apply a patch, but you don't know how it will affect the system. So we want to be able to clone it, like, so we have the known semi-working system that might have a security bug, but you know it works right. So you can clone it, apply the patch to it, run them in parallel, and see if they sort of do the same, they do the same thing within the same. So, yes.
You know, asking what Tom did again, did you run an environment like that in your experimental? Was that a specific test that was run?
No, this is just the sort of the first part of the, like, the vision. It goes applying it as a general mechanism, but we haven't, but we have thought about it, but we haven't gone there yet.
Okay, thanks.
And at the back, next question.
Yeah, I first of all would like to say, I hope there's no auditors in this room or have read your paper. Rob Banz from Google. I also thought this system would be awesome for training and system administration classes, classroom work. This is how I would possibly want to give my final exam to some students and then go and grade their work if I had these.
You could probably do, like, the prototype we used, mm-hmm. could probably be very usable for that.
Yeah, I think that would be a good target. Yeah.
David Nolan with Ariba. I was wondering if you've thought about where the next step would be in terms of, like, trying to apply this beyond a single system, because obviously none of us run individual systems in a vacuum, right? This system talks to other systems. I know, for example, VMware has a product, I can't remember the name, Cluster Manager or Lab Manager or something like that, where basically you can have a whole suite of VMs that it can clone as a set, and it, you know, it tweaks all your network configs. So you get two groups of the same VMs, and they all think their networks are the same still, but, you know, it's done NAT for access to the outside world and stuff, so you can take a set. I don't know. Have you thought about taking this to that level? Because obviously, when in a real-world environment, you know, even with a single server, I can't clone a server and have it still have the same IP as the live server and be installing software on it or testing.
So, if you seem to be asking how we can manage large numbers of machines.
Not large numbers of machines, but even just shared resources. Like, an IP address is a shared resource, right? I can't have a clone have the same IP as my live server and be working. So if I'm cloning a web server that accesses a database server, you need to clone the database server as well.
Okay, so you're asking how does it work when there are sort of multiple components that, like, this, like, if this machine's talking to a database server, we can't have two machines trying to write the same rows.
Right.
That was one of the things I spoke about in sort of difficulty with databases. But it is stuff we spoke about. I can probably speak more offline because I'm probably running out of time for questions if you want to. It is a complicated issue.
Yeah. The VMware project might be something to look at for handling that.
Okay. Thank you.